Welcome to Ukraine and Beyond and to my collaboration history series, Ukraine History in the Making. Over the next 4 months, Yevgenia Fedotova.
History is one of the maybe most interesting subjects in the school curriculum.
Olena Dudko.
Without knowing your past, you cannot build your future.
Elisabeth Polvas.
I think that it is of the urgent importance to the world hear us and the world hear how devastating is the Putin's war.
And I will present the history of Ukraine as it was, as it is, and as it hopefully will be. Now, let's get to the episode. Enjoy. Welcome to episode 3 of Ukraine History in the Making. Today we're going to talk about the downfall of Kyiv, the destruction of Kievan Rus, which was very much, much caused by the Mongol invasion in the year 1237. That was when it started. And in the two first episodes, where Jane, you were on in the first one, you presented the story of ancient Ukraine. And then the last time, Elisabeth presented the story of Kievan Rus. And today it will be me presenting. So today I will have a role that is sort of a mix between host and presenter of today's period. But I think that maybe you can say some words, Jane, about what you're expecting from today's episode and maybe like some of your background knowledge, if you can say it like that.
Yeah, hello everyone, and thank you, Mihail, again for being brave enough to choose not so glamorous historical periods in the history of Ukraine, because I remember that when I was at school and at university, we just didn't discuss very much in detail this period, because it's rather set period for us. And you started that the Kyiv was destroyed, and right now we still have like Eastern power who wants to destroy us, because like this morning in Kyiv was horrible, and we have around 20-25 people injured after explosions. And I would like to delve into how this Mongolian approach of capturing lands and destructing any like cultural heritage on these lands reflects in nowadays tactics of Russian army, because I can find some similarities, and of course Russia has its own history with Mongolian. It's interesting, and I hope that this episode can still give a hook of hope for next episodes, because Kyiv is still standing, and I hope it will keep standing many years in future.
And I just want to react a bit to the first thing you said about being grateful that I would present this period. And I think that initially when I said that I wanted to present the story of the invasion of the Mongol Empire of Kievan Rus, I didn't realize actually at that point how horrendous a story this is, because I was probably more thinking about it in terms of this general historical interest I very much have in, especially like conflicts and wars and political upheaval and so on. But as soon as I then started to dig deeper into what possibly and to a certain degree we know happened in this period, it just it was very clear to me that this is actually some pretty dark things and some pretty evil, I guess, things we're going to be discussing today. I don't really know how to describe it in any other way, and I'm sure that the listeners will also realize this as I go through some of the events that occurred during the Mongolian invasion. And I also talked with Elizabeth last time about that here in the beginning. We are going to dedicate a few minutes to talking about one of the general themes that we are putting into this story we are telling about the history of Ukraine. And I've narrowed it down to four now. And there is this theme about geography. So how do we see connections between different geography locations? How do we... And then there is the continuation of Ukrainian history. So that's when you look at today and then draw lines back in history. Then there is the misinformation, of course, which is very much down to this information war there is. And then the last one is the colonial perspective. And all of these themes obviously also is connected, but I was the one suggesting the name Ukraine History in the Making, and I would like to take this possibility to dwell a bit further into this concept. And it is because when I look at Ukraine, I see a history that is not just today, but also historically much more dynamic than that of my own country, Denmark, for example. So you can, for example, look at the period that we're going to talk about today, which it is actually mainly a quite short period, because a lot of the things that we will discuss today actually happens in a very short amount of time. But Denmark as a political entity, the political entity that controls Denmark today, the territory that is under that political entity was like this ever since the year 900, around the year 900 in Denmark. And Denmark did expand and shrunk also during history. But you can fairly say that the political entity that is Denmark has been Denmark ever since the year 900, roughly so. And that is just so different from Ukraine, for example, where we see so many different political entities ruling over these different territories. And I actually think that a lot of that is a heritage also of what happened during the Mongolian invasion. And now we see again that Ukraine is invaded by an aggressor from the east. Obviously, you cannot make direct comparisons between Russia of today and the Mongol Empire back in the days, but it is just still this general theme about Ukraine being invaded by a power from the east without Ukraine having any desire whatsoever to fall under the influence of an external threat from the east. And as we've said so many times, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And I really think that what we see today is also something from which we can draw a line back to the Mongolian invasion of Kyiv. And if not in a concrete sense, then at least on a subconscious level in the minds of Ukrainians. But do you have some things to say here in the beginning as well, Jane?
No, again, I can only second you that definitely history is rhyming, and luckily it was short periods on our lands, because the period of time when you are suppressed by such authority that has way different political culture than your own. Like, for instance, if we compare Kiev Rus and Mongolian Empire, their political culture was very different from each other. So yeah, like, I'm really happy that it was short period of our history, and I believe we need to dig into details to understand, like, why luckily we didn't feel so much influence from those periods of time in our modern political culture.
Yeah, and I actually think that is a great thing to keep in mind also later in the episode, that that we can talk a bit more about this the fact that maybe it didn't carry that much influence into, like, today's political Ukraine. But I think then, without much further ado, I think I will get to the, like, concrete historical events now, and yeah, take you with me on a journey to explore the sad downfall of Kiev and the Mongol invasion.
And that Ukraine is an ancient independent nation. Ukraine has a history of more than 1,000 years. Kiev was a major metropolis and cultural center when Moscow was not even a village.
And here I would like to start off by talking about where we finished the last time. And we finished the last time by talking about Kiev and Rus in its gold age, spanning from the year 1000 to 1200. In that period and the centuries before, we heard the great stories of Volodymyr the Great, Yaroslav the Wise, who was also called father-in-law of Europe. We heard the story about Queen Olga, who deceived the Byzantine emperor. So year 1000 to 1200 really was a great time for Kiev and Rus. And I also think it is a point of history that a lot of Ukrainians look back at with great pride, and rightly so. With Kiev as its center, Kiev and Rus achieved enormous results in the fields of military, science, art, architecture, and governance. This, along with visionary leadership from the likes of Volodymyr, Yaroslav, and Olga, paved the way for the flourishing of a state spanning from the Black Sea to the Baltics. But unfortunately, this is not what we are going to talk about today. But I had to say this to set the stage. Because, as we have already mentioned, today we will be talking about the devastating destruction of Kiev and Rus, a downfall that came with the Mongol invasion from the year 1237 to 1241. And I just want to say here, before I start talking about what happened, that this is going to be a very dark episode that just gets all the more darker when you consider all the great things that came before. And to me, it is really striking that the story of Kiev and Rus is a period about which so many Europeans know so little. But I think that's a result of two things. The first thing is that the Mongols really made sure that none of the power that had formed the basis for Kiev and Rus could arise again anytime soon. The rulers were annihilated, churches were destroyed, and atrocities were committed upon the people, leaving no room for the reemergence of any power willing to challenge the rule of the Mongols, at least for quite a while. And the second reason for the lack of knowledge about Kiev and Rus, I think, is that it wasn't until 1991 that a political entity arose, the state of Ukraine, which had its ancestral roots in Kiev and Rus. So instead, the story of Kiev and Rus became the victim of historical propaganda, namely from Russia, because that fitted their political needs. So that's just like a short leeway before getting into the story of today, which is the story of the downfall of Kievan Rus and the subsequent Mongolian rule. I don't know, Jane, do you have anything to add here before I delve into the first segment?
No, I believe that faster we start discussing like what was going on in that period, it would be easier to raise like real questions, not only historical but geopolitically. So please, the floor is yours.
And the first segment I have named Kievan Rus in its later years before the invasion by the Mongols, because once again, the last time we really finished off on a high note talking about Kievan Rus. So I want to sort of draw out the political landscape of later Kievan Rus leading up to the invasion. So the last time we finished with the period of Yaroslav the Wise children, roughly so, and the time that I'll talk about now begins about two generations after Yaroslav's death, after he died in 1054, and that was when Mitislav the Great in 1130 had expelled all the descendants of Vyacheslav the Seer or Sorcerer to the Byzantine Empire. And to make a long story very short, what happened from the year 1054 to 1130 was what we see in almost all political entities throughout history, a succession crisis. So after Yaroslav the Wise, there was a succession crisis in Kievan Rus, and this guy Vyacheslav was a contender to Mitislav, and Mitislav was a great grandson of Yaroslav the Wise. So that's just important also to be aware of before getting to the invasion, that there were all these political internal struggles also in Kievan Rus, which I think is important to mention. But shortly after, Mitislav then dies in the year 1133, and he was the last one to rule a united Kievan Rus. And by the end of the 12th century, Kievan Rus kind of fragmented into roughly 12 principalities. And in this period, you actually also have the Fourth Crusade, where Constantinople was sacked. And the Fourth Crusade, and what I'm talking about here, is the year 1204. But because Constantinople was sacked, the Dnipro trade route also became much less attractive. So this also contributed to the decline of Kievan Rus. We also see at this time Northern Crusaders attacking the Baltics in the Republic of Novgorod, also contributing to the weakening of Rus lands. And this is also, I think, a good leeway to talk a bit about Novgorod, because Novgorod was a part of Kievan Rus in its most northern and eastern parts that in the year 1136 rebelled against Kiev, and actually succeeding in gaining status as an independent republic. So that was like an... The reason why that's important is because when we get to later periods, we see that it was important that some of these principalities and republics emerged out of Kievan Rus as well. So that's important to be aware of, I think, here. And going further on, there are two more things that I want to mention before getting to the invasion. And the first thing, I said that Kiev and Rus fragmented into 12 different principalities. And one of the principalities that we know of for sure was the Grand Principality of Vladimir Suzdal. And the reason why this is important is because Moscow was a part of that principality. And like later, Moscow also had its own principality after the invasion of Kiev and Rus, which was basically what formed into what later became Russia. So there is just all these small little things I at least think is important to take notice of, because it just goes to show how important every single little event can be throughout history. When I guess you can say analyzing how things play together in the end. But the other thing is that Yaropolk II of Kiev, who was the son of Mieczyslaw that I talked about before, when he, during his rule, he had to deal with this growing power of Novgorod, meaning that he couldn't focus on another an external threat, which was the Cumans. So the Cumans were people that lived just east of the lands of Kiev and Rus, and they were an external threat to Kiev and Rus before the Mongol invasion, but he couldn't really deal with them because he had to take care of this threat from Novgorod. So that also weakened Kiev and Rus. And there is a lot of other things that I could also talk about before getting to the invasion. The most important one is probably the sack of Kiev in 1169 by a coalition of native princes. But I think the stage is now set for talking about the Mongol invasion. And just before getting to the story of the Mongol invasion, I would like to say that, yes, we have this fragmentation, we have all these succession crises, and we have these political struggles in Kiev and Rus, but it is just important to remember that although all this happened, there was still some sort of political unity connecting all these different principalities and all these people. So although there were conflicts like we see in all like earlier state formations and in all earlier empires and so on, and although what Kiev and Rus was in its golden age probably wasn't what it was in its later stages, there was absolutely no reason for the total collapse of Kiev and Rus if it hadn't been for the Mongol invasion. And I just think it's important to realize both of these things, so that Kiev and Rus was not just some fairy tale story that had this princess and the princesses and alliances all around Europe and no war and only made great achievements in science, law, and so on. Like, it wasn't only that. There were also political fragmentation, there were political struggles, there were rebellions, attacks, and so on. But although there were all that, that isn't an argument to say that Kiev and Rus was completely, that it had completely collapsed, or that it wouldn't have had like a massive heritage if it hadn't been for the invasion, which I'm going to talk about later. But I just think it's important to say these things as well, to make a fair historical account about what happened. And I'm sure Elizabeth would have also said those things, but maybe we ran a bit low on time. But that's basically the situation we then have, Jane, in like late 12th century and in the beginning of the 13th century. We have like a weakened Kiev and Rus, both because of internal conflicts, because of an external threat from the Cumans, and then also because the Fourth Crusade sacked Constantinople and paved the way for other trade routes that then went around Kiev and Rus, thereby contributing to an economic decline. But I think also based upon what you said before, it probably makes sense for me to then just go straight into the Mongol invasion now, unless you have like a few.
If I can just quickly add regarding one event that happened in the late 11th century, that was called the Council of Lubich, or like in Ukrainian, Lubitsky Zhizd. And it was initiated by Volodymyr Monomakh. And the idea of this council was, again, like to talk about this fragmentation, but it's not only like, okay, like let's define these borders between our principalities. No, the idea of this council was to low down all reasons for internal conflicts and be united in front of the external threat. And like maybe in the late 11th century, it was an okay idea, and princes agreed on it. But again, like I believe that. Still, even such fragmentation didn't solve this eager to capture neighboring principalities or like even capital principality Kiev. So that's why, unfortunately, Kiev Rus was weakened a lot by internal struggles just before the Mongolian Empire invasion. But again, like the idea of this fragmentation initially was very good, just to tame down all internal conflicts. Mm.
And let me just add to that also a point of reference that some can make look upon, because in a few hundred years before the rise of Kiev and Rus, we actually see a pretty similar situation arising in what was the Frankish Empire. So that also rose to become a great state entity. I'm not sure if they called themselves an empire, but Charlemagne, who was Charles the Great, from France, he basically united a very large territory spanning all the way from East Germany to Western France. But that political entity also, after he died, fell into a succession crisis between his sons and then between the sons of his sons later. So we see the exact same process happen. Not the exact same, of course, but we see a very similar process occurring just a few hundred years before in a state entity that has a lot of the same components very close to Kiev and Rus. So it's just to I really don't want to distort the greatness of Kiev and Rus by talking a bit about its internal conflicts, because I really don't think that's a fair way of looking at it. Yeah, and if we talk about France, you can also say that like France has this great story about then we had the French Revolution, and then we became free, equal, and solidarity, ignoring that they had the Napoleonic Wars shortly after all this. So it's just that like people just really have to be not overthinking stuff, just because we then talk a little bit about that. Now, let's get to the Mongol invasion, because that really is the main point about the destruction of Kiev and Rus, the downfall of Kiev and Rus. So Kiev and Rus wasn't destroyed by internal conflicts. Kiev and Rus wasn't destroyed because different principalities couldn't get along, or because different rulers had like personal issues or something like that. That's not why Kiev and Rus was destroyed. That was because of the Mongol invasion from the east. And now I think we get to it. And I just want to, like once again, before I start talking about it, I just really want to stress how tragic a period this is. But yeah, as mentioned, by the end of the 12th century, Kiev and Rus was split into these roughly 14 principalities, and that is important to be aware of when talking about the Mongol invasion. because the Mongols conquered Kiev not with one large battle or like all defining battle, but rather through a series of battles which were fought between different principalities and armies that were challenged throughout the 4 years it took for the Mongol Empire to finally destroy Kievan Rus, ending with the Battle of Kiev in late 1240. So actually, the Mongols already came to the land of Kievan Rus in 1223. I actually think they had like a small army over there with around 20,000 cavalry, which is horsemen, but though didn't really came that much out of that invasion. So the Mongols basically went back home after that and finished off some other problems, not problems, like other invasions. They had other expansionist wars. And then sometimes history, you really have to take it on like, I don't want to say low level, but sometimes you can use these pretty easy explanations. So I think you can basically say that, so they were in the lands of Kievan Rus in the year 1223. That was when Genghis Khan was the ruler of the Mongol Empire, but they pulled that army back. Then they finished off some things closer to Mongolia. Then Genghis Khan died and he had his son, and I think that the name is Ubadeh Khan is what he's known as. And then they talked and they basically agreed that the next thing we're going to do is to launch an all-out invasion of the lands of Rus. So then they spent a lot of years preparing for that. And then in the year 1237, that's when it all really began. And the way that I've structured it is that I would like to go through like roughly the battles that they had and the sieges that they committed in the lands of Rus, paving the way to the final siege of Kiev in late 1240. And the place to begin is with the battle of the Voronezh River. And once again, it's just important to keep in mind how big a territory Kievan Rus like influenced over and had control over. So Voronezh River is pretty far away from Kiev today. But this was where the Mongol invasion of Kievan Rus began in December 1237. And the Mongols attacked the principality of Ryazan at the Voronezh River. That's what the battle is named after. And to give an idea about just how strong the Mongols were, the army that Batu, he was the commander of the Mongols in that battle, the army that he invaded with consisted of around 120,000 to 140,000 men. And by the way, there is a lot of things about Mongol leadership I leave out because I want to focus on the territories of Kievan Rus more specifically, meaning that we just don't have the time to cover all these otherwise very important things about the Mongols. Anyways, some say that, yeah, as I mentioned, it was 120,000 to 140,000. Some say that's a bit of an overestimation because of the 12 tumens, the units in which Mongolians fought did not all consist of 10,000 fighting men. But I think it is safe to say that the Mongols invaded with at least around 100,000 soldiers. And then on the Kievan Rus side, far less are believed to have fought. So the Rus units were comprised of Drushinas, which is like elite units, but there were only around 100, as far as I can tell, in these units. And then there were militias, which were also units of the Rus armies, but they were fighting on foot. And this is obviously so long ago, so there is nothing that anyone can be really sure about. But when you look at the sources, there is only like five princes that are mentioned and that were accompanied by these Drusinas that I talked about before. So in that way, I think it's safe to say that the Rus really fought with not that many elite units, especially not compared to the Mongols. So although they also had the militias on foot, it was a pretty foregone conclusion what the outcome of the battle would be. And some of that is also because of the fact that the regular units in the Mongolian army were just much better than their counterparts, the militias on foot from the Rus.
Mm.
So that was the first battle between Rus and the Mongols, and the result was an overwhelming victory for the Mongols. And there is this story about three princes waiting for reinforcements of Vladimir, another prince, and that those reinforcements never came. And that was when they realized that this battle was lost and that they had to flee. And I think the reason why this battle is important is it's the first one, and it is the one that really sets the stage for the initial Mongol conquest of a lot of lands in the northeastern part of Kievan Rus. And yeah, I've written some things about other sieges following just this, but I think I will go over it shortly. But basically, what happens after the victory of the Mongols at the Voronezh River is that over a very short period, only from December 1237 until February 1238, so it's only around 2 to 3 months, the Mongols, they lay siege to Ryazan, Kolomna, Moscow, and Vladimir, which were cities of Kievan Rus back then, that they went from like, they went up, I guess you can say, they went like north and then a bit east and then a bit to the west, but a lot in the lands that is today Russia. And they conquered all these cities. And I just want to mention one thing about casualties from these battles, because I also think that this sheds some light about what would be the later casualties after the destruction of Kiev. And I think the one that best captures it is what is written about the casualties in the siege of Ryazan. And this basically goes, the population of Ryazan in the 13th century, it is hard to estimate. Archaeological excavations on the site of old Ryazan in 1915 and 1979 uncovered 97 severed heads on the site of the former church and 143 bodies in several mass graves, all of whom had met violent deaths during the sack of the city. So that is like a depiction of just how horrendous the atrocities the Mongols committed in the lands that they conquered. But moving on from this period, and it is just so interesting that it all happens so fast, actually. But we have these 2 to 3 months where they conquer all this land in the northern eastern part of Kievan Rus. And then it seems that after that, what they did was that they prepared for what would then be the later invasions of Kievan Rus' heartland in the principality of, or you must maybe help me here, Chernihov
or Chernihiv in more like Ukrainian pronunciation.
Okay, yeah. But that principality, yeah, because what came after these very fast victories for the Mongolians was the siege of Kozelsk, which is in the principality of Chernihiv, which is a lot closer to Kyiv. And what we see here is that the siege of Kursk was a much more difficult task for the Mongols. And that siege actually took around 6 weeks before they finally captured Kursk, paving the way for the destruction of Kyiv. And some of, like what we also see in this siege is that the Rus people, they fight back way more fiercely here. So during these 6 weeks, a lot of the people fighting for like the Principality of Chernihiv, they basically knowingly sacrificed their life in the like during the defense of the city. And actually, some of the Mongols after this siege, like they, so spoiler, they eventually captured Kursk and won that battle. But afterwards, you see like Mongolian leaders and people referring to Kursk as like the city of evil, which is kind of contradictory considering that you went there to basically sack the city and the population. But they came up with this term about this city being evil because this city resisted more the invasion. But this was then, this victory was finally achieved for the Mongols in May 1238. So still not that long after what I was talking about before. But then what happens after is that the Mongolians seem to they went north as well, abandoning a quest in Novgorod. But what they didn't seem to do was to make preparations for the capture of Kyiv. I said there was a lot of things we need to cover, but there is a thing that I think we have to mention, which is that in 1238, after the fall of Kursk, the Grand Prince of Kyiv, Michael, who had also been in political trouble with Hungary and so on, he then, before the final invasion of Kyiv, actually flees to Hungary. And then another person, I think it was Rostislav, is placed as the leader of Kyiv. But then shortly, this all happens in the period of 1238, 1239, and 1240. It's also a very short period. But Rostislav is then later replaced by the like the voyage of Daniel of Galicia, I think. And he was named, I need to look at my notes here. He was named Dmytro. So Dnipro was like at least the presumed leader of Kyiv, I guess you can say, when the invasion begins. But it is just once again to also say here that there were these political troubles also weakening Kyiv before the final invasion of the Mongols. And when the Mongols then invaded and raided the heartlands of Kievan Rus, that was in 1240 and still under the command of Batu. And what we see in 1240, the way I read it, is actually that when he started these raids towards Kyiv, like the city Kyiv, in the beginning he wasn't really met by so much resistance, so that like in the lands leading up to Kyiv, the Mongolian fighters, the Mongolian men, were basically left to their own devices, so to say. So they could pretty much pillage, raid, and do whatever they wanted. Once again, of course, I don't say that there weren't any resistance at all, but that's like the general picture that you get. But this leads us up to the final siege of Kyiv, which happened in late 1240. So we have this situation where the Mongolian invaders have reached like the very close proximity of Kiev. And then they start the siege. And I think it was on, I will just like read straight up from what I wrote in the notes. So the siege began on November 28th when the Mongols set up three catapults near the three gates of Old Kiev. The Mongols then began a bombardment that lasted several days. On December 6th, Kiev's walls were breached and hand-to-hand combat followed in the streets. The Kievans suffered heavy losses and Dmytro was wounded by an arrow. When night fell, the Mongols held their positions while the Kievans retreated to the central parts of the city. Many people were crowded into the Church of the Tides. The next day, as the Mongols commenced the final, assault, the church balcony collapsed under the weight of the people standing on it, crushing many. After the Mongols won the battle, they plundered Kiev. Most of the population was massacred. Out of 50,000 inhabitants before the invasion, about 2,000 survived. Most of the city was burned, and only 6 out of 40 major buildings remained standing. Dmytro, however, was shown mercy for his bravery. So, yeah, that's the very sad conclusion of Kievan Rus. And when you look in the historical annals, you also see that Kievan Rus is stated to have fallen on this day, like, or in this month, December of 1940. And then somewhere it carries on a bit onto 1941, but yeah, but this battle really was the final destruction. And I think, yeah, the fact that so few people survived just speaks volume to just how big an atrocity this was. And I think that when you take into account also the other things I mentioned about Mongolian atrocities before this, It almost pains me to say, but I can only imagine, yeah, what the population of Kiev undergone at that time, and yeah, very, very brutal. But that's history as well. That's also history, and maybe I can mention here, because obviously a very sad time for Ukrainians and not a nice time to look back upon, but yeah, the Ukrainians aren't the only people that have experienced such things. And not to make comparisons directly, but like, there's also other people throughout history that have been entirely destroyed and wiped out of existence. So yeah, this is just insane, yeah. So we'll talk a bit about the rule after, but I think maybe it's a good time for you also to say a few things here.
Kiev was not ruled by Moscow. They were not part of the same political entity. For centuries, Kiev was looking westwards.
Yeah, sure. I just want to talk about like two locations in Kiev. Like, one is the remnants of the Church of Tides. And also, again, like, for me, it's very interesting because I have never seen like even like one part of wall there, but I saw a lot of pictures like from 17th century, 18th century, that there were like at least walls standing after the siege of Kiev. And actually in the mid of 19th century, the church was rebuilt itself. But then the Soviets came, and in 1928, again, this church was blown up. So it's a horrible tradition of let's say, like, okay, like in the Mongolian Empire, the face was different, but in the Soviet Union, there was like no religion, no face. So just destroying such cultural remarks for very important for locals, it's horrible. And yeah, like right now, you can see only basement of this church, but again, like it's very memorable place for Ukrainians. And the second location I would like to talk, this place is called the Mountain of Batyi, and it is located not far from the Olympijski National Stadium. Like maybe someone who watched Euro 2012, like this football tournament, maybe you remember this.
I did. Yeah, of course. I'm not sure, but I watched. I was actually in Ukraine back then. No, I'm not even lying.
Okay, so maybe this discussion is not for this episode, but for future. So, yeah, like this mountain is just like 5 minutes from this stadium. And I remember, again, like when I was little, my parents like very lightheartedly told me that, oh, like Jane, you know, like this mountain is where Khan Batyi was standing, looking at Kyiv and like building his plans how to capture Kyiv. And like, you know, it sounded like a funny story. But like when I grew up, I understand that like actually like this location is very like it is very high, and right now it's a skiing road. So like if you like skis or snowboarding, like you can go there and take a slope. Yeah, but honestly, like it's not historical or nothing like that. So only like local people can go and say that this is a place where Khan Batyi started his siege of Kyiv. But yeah, it's interesting like how our memory just wants to erase negative connotations of places. So yeah, these two locations are quite interesting to visit when you're in Kyiv.
I will see if I can get time to do it the next time I come. I also want to talk a little bit about Mongolian rule, but I don't know. Do you have any thoughts about this? Because I haven't written that much down. So maybe if you want to tell a bit about the things that you thought about concerning Mongolian rule, you can do that, and then I can maybe like supplement with some of the facts that I have in the notes.
So, again, I remember that there was a special permission to rule over lands like issued by Mongolians. And this permission was called Yarlik. It's like, if you translate it, it will mean like label. And I remember, again, like, there is no, like, written proof of this procedure, but, like, in our history books, it was described that to get this yerlik, local members of local authorities, they needed to crawl down to the shoes of a Mongolian ruler to kiss it and ask for permission to rule over this land. And same happened over the modern territory of Ukraine, like besides western part, and also in Russia. But in Russia, it was, again, like, it is just said, like, maybe it's, again, a part of propaganda, but now from Ukrainian side, that Russian local authorities, they even didn't plan any rebellion against the Mongolian rulers, so they were okay with inheriting their traditions, their, like, cultural parts, and even now, like, when you go to Tatarstan, like this, not the most southern parts of Russia, but just above them, you will still see the remnants of this Mongolian Empire culture. So yeah, like oppression, tyranny, and zero integration in the pre-existing local context. That's how we can characterize Mongolian rule.
Yeah, I don't have too much to supplement. Maybe just to also give a good springboard to the next episode, so we don't have to cover this much more. But what basically followed in terms of time, dates, and so on, was that Kiev, like the lands of Kiev and Rus, they came under Mongolian rule for around 200 years, and I think it was first in the I lose the English word a bit here, but the foundation for it was the Golden Horde, which kind of transformed in a certain way into the Tatar yoke, which was then what ruled these lands. And we also know today of Tatars living in Ukraine and the Crimean Khanate and so on. So you obviously had this influence. You also see this heritage in modern Ukraine and so on. But I think, and maybe to be fair to the Mongolians, after all, you can also mention that these hundreds of years were relatively peaceful. So that although they committed all these atrocities, in consensus storytelling, they formed quite a peaceful period as well. But it's also important to mention just how much, this is maybe more of a personal opinion, but I really think that this occupation and this rule set back the lands of Ukraine a lot in its in what was otherwise its way to become more, I guess you can say, in traditional Western European sense, more civilized and build up all these governance structures and so on. So yeah, although it was peaceful, it was still a huge setback. That's at least how I view it. But one last thing, it will be a bit longer than an hour today, but I still think we can keep it in these 1 hour and 15 minutes maximum. But I think an important thing to mention here is that, and this is also a lesson for life, I guess, and also a lesson for geopolitical thinking, is that today we have Crimean Tatars, and in an earlier version of Ukraine, maybe that's not the right way to put it, but in Ukraine during the Soviet Union, you also had Crimean Tatars living in Crimea. And my general feeling is that Crimean Tatars and Ukrainians, although they have, to say the least, a pretty complicated history, they actually live fine along with each other today. And you also see that the defense minister or something like that, right, is a Crimean Tatar, like the defense minister of Ukraine. So although you have all these conflicts in the past, I at least think that you see Ukrainians, like ethnic Ukrainians, I guess you can say, and like ethnic Tatars, that they are coming along today. So although you have had this, of course, it's more than 1,000 years ago, so that play around 1,000 years ago, so that plays a role. But it just goes to show that people can come to terms with their shared conflictful past and still live together peacefully. And that's a lesson, I think, at least, that the Russians for sure haven't learned yet. But do you have anything to I know.
So again, maybe it's just a spoiler for future episodes, but Ukrainians and Tatars were not enemies all the time. No, they were joint companies against Moscow. Also, during this 13th century, 13th and 14th century, Galician princes, they joined up with Tatars and they went to the Hungarian lands again to find to fight for some trade routes. So again, it wasn't like purely ideological alliance, let's say so, but we cooperated a lot in the past as well. So again, those Tatars who came to lands of Kiev Rus in 12th and 13th centuries, it's not the same people who live in Crimea right now. So history, honestly, like Ukrainian geographical position forces us to find allies according to tendencies around us. So like we were allies with Poland. So once upon a time, Bohdan Khmelnytsky made a mistake and created an alliance with Moscow. So yeah, honestly, like if you look at countries that surround Ukraine, we were like allies and enemies in this or that period of time within our history. So yeah, maybe this adjustability is what helped Ukrainians and Tatars in 18th and later centuries to get on well with each other. But yeah, I can't say that this period that we were discussing within this episode is like brought up quite oftenly. So no, even in any materials, like historical materials that based on some textbooks, this period is just omitted, let's say so.
Yeah, and I guess maybe the point here is also that you have a country like Russia, for example, and for some reason, Russia just seems to be a country that really hasn't come to terms with its own past, and therefore they constantly feel the need to keep manipulating history, keep doing propaganda, and keep doing all these things that creates an image of Ukrainians and Westerners as being an enemy of Russia, although that is not like so. This is the way I see it, and of course it is a bit with all that has happened and so on, but let's say hypothetically that Russia didn't do what it did in Crimea and Eastern Ukraine after the revolution of Maidan. Let's say that the political leader of Russia had just said, all right, the Ukrainians did this. This is what they want to do. And we want to live peacefully coexisting with them. I believe in that case, the Ukrainians wouldn't have depicted the Russians as enemies either. And I don't think that it is I guess you can say some political entities, they just are wired, it almost seems, to always imagine that they have external threats, that they have external enemies, and therefore they also start their history to fit that narrative. And maybe the Crimean Tatars and the Ukrainians are not the best example of this. Maybe you could look at Poland and Germany, for example, Germany and France, Germany and Denmark, Germany and Belgium. These are all countries, political entities with a shared past where we have killed each other, where we have invaded each other, where we have destroyed, sacked cities and so on. But these countries don't have conflicts today. They don't have anything that resembles the conflict Russia has brought upon between Russia and Ukraine. I guess that was because there was this Mongol invasion of Ukraine. But you just don't see the remnants of like this historical disagreement or conflict arising all the time, as you do with Russia. Do you have anything to add here, Jane, or do you think we can like talk about some of the themes?
Brief comments that like regarding your examples with Germany, Denmark, France, Poland, etc. These countries know how to like make self reflection. Unfortunately, there is no sign of self-analysis within Russian society, so that's why we don't see it. And like, okay, even if Russia hasn't committed what they did after the Revolution of Dignity in 2014, there is still a very black page of deportation of Crimean Tatars happened in 1944, approved by Stalin and etc. And Russia claims that they are, they are successors of USSR, and there was no apology to Crimean Tatars whose families were deported. And also today, again, it's in commemoration of deportation of Lithuanians, Estonians, and Latvians. So modern Russia even hasn't apologized to Baltic states. And it seems like Russia respects these countries more. I don't know. I'm not sure. But again, like geopolitically, it looks like. So even if nothing has happened in 2014, we have a long list of Russian crimes. So yeah, unfortunately, it's not as easy to coexist as an equal states with Russia. So that's why, unfortunately, your scenario is very optimistic. And just the last thing that I want to mention, the link between the Mongolian Empire and the Duchess of Moscow is very interesting, because one of Mongolian Khans, Khan Takhtamysh, he helped founding this political system that the Duchess of Moscow then followed. And even on like the first coins of Moscow Duchess, there was like a picture of Khan Takhtamysh. So they have this component of Mongolian political culture, like not modern Mongolian, like very old Mongolian culture, but they just pretend that it was like their own very unique system. So with having this mindset that whoever contributed to our modern status, modern state, it's not their part, it's not their contribution, it's only ours. So again, like to have such neighbor is painfully difficult. So yeah.
All right. And we're really approaching the end here. And if we had the time, I would have had some questions for all these four themes. But I think maybe the theme of the continuation of Ukrainian history has already had a huge part today. So maybe we don't have to do that one. And I also think that, let me just one thing. Geography, I already talked a bit about as well. So maybe we can skip that. And then maybe I would like to ask you concerning the two themes of like misinformation, Russian propaganda and so on, and the colonial perspective, because this is the first time we see what is today Ukraine really come under the control of an occupier. And I also stumbled upon, I think, in the research for this, what I, to a certain degree, consider as Russian propaganda when reading about it, which is like Russia trying to claim some of this history about the resistance done by Kievan Rus during this invasion. So in some ways, somewhere it is almost written as if this was Russia's like great history of resistance or something, with some of the battles and so on. So that's a sort of a misinformation perspective, at least. But yeah, can you maybe share some thoughts about these two themes, connecting it to the story that I told today?
Yeah, sure. Like regarding Russia, of course, like maybe it's a part of misinformation, but they just shift accents in their history, and like there is like one fighter whose name is Ivan Kalita, and he helped in destroying Mongols in Tver. Like it is also a city somewhere in Russia. So just by having this one example of resistance in their history, they exaggregated it and portrayed it as a great resistance through the whole territory. So I wouldn't say that there was like a great Russian movement against the Mongolian rule, because again, like on one hand you have like this one Ivan Kalita, and on the second hand you have Mongolian Huns who helped founding cities and established their rules over the territory. And also like the parts of misinformation that Russia spreads is that the Mongolian rule was on the territory of Kiev Rus and Russia for 200 years, but like on the territory of Kiev Rus it was slightly more than 120 years. So again, like someone can say that oh, like, but it's a difference only in 80 years, but 80 years is almost three generations of people, so it has quite an impact. So yeah, and regarding colonial perspective, these post-colonial studies are still something very new for Ukrainians, and we are trying, like, you know, with the period that is still closest to us, like we dig into USSR and we dig into Russian Empire, but okay, like we have quite a positive view of Lithuanian, Polish and Lithuanian commonwealths. We are very like accurate about Austrian-Hungarian Empire and Polish influence on western parts of Ukraine, but regarding Mongolian rule over Ukraine, it's, first of all, it's hard to find all resources and litopuses, like ancient books. Unfortunately, our scientific corp of historians isn't enough to analyze such distant periods from our modern history. And again, like right now we luckily we don't have any attacks from Mongolia, and there is no demand on both sides, I must say, like to dig into how interconnected we were back in the days. So maybe if there was some demand, there would be some researches, and we could discuss about colonial perspective of Mongolian rule. And again, I don't see that there were a lot of examples of Mongolian Kiev Rus art or any impact on maybe our music or etc. Like later, it was like, I can say that Mongols, Tatars and Turks image was like mixed together for like common people, because there were different invasions, people were captured and etc. So there was like a common stereotype about these people. But it's not very scientific, it's not historical, but yeah, like we still can see some like traces of these old biases in our like, you know, some catchy phrases and etc., but it's like very minor, and it's more used in literatures and in day-to-day language. So yeah,
perfect. I think that is a good way to sort of go out today. Besides that, I just want to thank you also for coming on for the fourth time, I think, actually now in my conversation series. So that probably makes you the very best friend of my show, Ukraine and Beyond. So I'm very happy about that. And besides that, yes, so now mentioning that my conversation series overall is called Ukraine and Beyond. So if some listeners maybe are a bit confused that they see Ukraine and Beyond, but then it's called Ukraine History in the Making in the titles and in the logo, that's because this history series is a part of my overall conversation series. And right now I'm really focusing on Ukrainian history and doing this series, yeah, with you and Olena and Lisa. So that's why, just to explain that if anyone thought about it. And otherwise, I would just suggest once again all the listeners to go find us on our social media platforms. I am on an account I call Ukraine Fluencing, and yeah, obviously that's an like sort of an abbreviation of Ukrainian influencing combined, but that's what the account is called, and that's because I really think that what I do is Ukraine Fluencing, influencing positively for Ukraine, and that's where you will find most videos from this conversation, like from this history series. So like short videos, maybe also some with some graphics in the future and so on. So that's probably like the most obvious to follow, but also follow Jane on Jane Fedotova on Instagram, and the others will also be in the description. So like, follow, and share. Let's get the story of Ukraine out everywhere. It's also a message that I want to pass on. Do you have anything to say here in the very end?
Well, that was a great episode. And again, like, I'm very grateful for your empathy that you have for modern Ukrainians and for Ukrainians back in the days. So yeah, thank you so much, Emil. And yeah, I'm really happy to help in Ukraine Fluencing. So yeah, till the next episode.
Yeah, you kind of have to like, when you first get it, I think then it becomes natural, but it is sort of a funny word, maybe, I guess you can say, but I think it does really capture what I'm doing pretty well, because it is influencing for Ukraine online, and that can be called Ukraine Fluencing. And maybe one last thing to everyone still listening, go and get more historical knowledge, also just in general, like about everything, because I really, really believe that having more historical knowledge is sort of the foundation actually for looking at contemporary geopolitics. And I just say that now based upon conversations with hundreds of people, like almost now, I think, talking about Ukraine, talking about geopolitics, and what really is the common denominator for everyone, I think, is able to talk about these things in a good level, is that they are all interested in history. They are all hugely interested in history. So yeah, it's not just good to know about Ukrainian history, it's good to know about history in general. So that's the last words for today. Bye bye. That was it from this week's episode. I really hope you guys enjoyed it and that you will follow along as we make our way throughout Ukrainian history. Besides that, I encourage everyone to find us on social media. There are links in the description. On social media, we will also post reels, videos, pictures, and other stuff to make all this easier to follow for you guys. And if you support our work, then why not like, follow, and share to get the story of Ukraine out everywhere. Hey, Slava Ukraini!